Today, we are talking Knock.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Talkin' Knock. I'm your host, Tristan, joined by my once and forever co-host, Peyton. How you doing, Peyton?
Well, before today, I would have been able to say I was doing fine, but after that session you just had with us, the dice gods are not happy for me. You know, doing okay, not doing great.
Yeah, Peyton's elf, John the Archivist, took quite a few hits today over and over and over again and has made it out of our adventure with one in all of his stats except intelligence, which he somehow ended up with higher than he started with. So that works out at least.
It's like the silver lining.
So before we get into the episode today, I just wanted to thank a few listeners who got us in touch with Matthew and Michael, the two artists from last session that I was unable to find any information about. I was able to get both of their Instagram accounts, and I've linked them in the previous show notes of the last episode, as well as on our Instagram, which leads me into my next point really fast, is that we have social media now. We've got a Twitter and an Instagram, and it's all stored on Linktree, which is going to be put in the description of every single one of these podcasts to make it really easy for everybody to go wherever they need to. But yeah, I mean, that's everything I have. So I guess without further ado, you want to dive right into these articles?
I'm super down.
Awesome. So the first one that we're doing is Monster Design from Classics, and it's specifically focused on the Lich. This was by Chris McDowell, which I will go into more actually after we finish talking about this article, because he's done a lot of really cool stuff that I feel like we need to talk about. Art was done by Tim Malloy, who obviously did the cover of Doc. And I don't know about you, but I love this art piece.
I love the art on this one, and then I also love the art on the next page, which is just like the portrait of the Lich.
Oh yeah, exactly. That's what I meant. The close-up face shot of the Lich is really almost chilling, honestly. Like, you open it and you're like, wow, he's staring right into my soul.
Yeah, it's something that, it's not well-defined. Like, it's just super round and ambiguous, but I feel like it plays into just the horrifying nature of the Lich.
So, what this article is it's focusing on something called the Cocktail Codex, which basically is this book that says that any cocktail or drink that you're dealing with in bartending is made from six bases, and their interactions with each other are what make those drinks. And I think that Chris tries really hard to pull that into the monsters, and I think he did a pretty good job. What about you?
I think he did a fantastic job. All of the examples that we're going to talk about in this article are just spot on.
Yeah, and it really was the first article when I read Knock the first time where I was like, wow, like this is really getting me thinking, how can I use this in my design? Rather than what it means to be playing OSR, this was more like, okay, here's some technical stuff that I can really just bite it, or I guess drink into, because it's cocktails, and really figure something out from. He starts with describing the Lich as his main character, and basically what he's trying to do is consolidate monster design into three things, which are the core, the balance, and the seasoning. Those three are the only part that I really disagreed with. What did you think specifically about starting with the Lich as a base?
I think starting with a Lich is a fantastic idea, just because depending on what setting you go with, it can go in so many different directions. However, I do agree with you in that he kind of defines these certain building blocks of the cocktail as this must come before this, which comes before this. And in my opinion, like those can be interchanged at any time without ruining the foundation.
Exactly, exactly. And what Chris says is that you go from the core, which is basically the base creature that you want to start out with. Then you go into the balance, which would be some type of weakness or something that it's dealing with that would make it more interesting to interact with in the game world. And in that way, it will sometimes have balance things like a phylactery for a witch, which oddly enough, I think you pointed out to me that he didn't mention the phylactery, which I thought was strange.
Yeah, I thought that was super strange how in this section that has to deal with lich weaknesses, it seems like one of the most quintessential one that comes to mind is a phylactery, and it isn't listed here, and I just don't know why.
Yeah, I think he was trying to go for like more oddball ones and giving more examples instead of just the Lich, which is totally fine. I'm all down for that. It just was strange that the phylactery wasn't there. But his last component of creating a creature is the seasoning, which is basically all of the lore and RP that you pull into making this thing. I personally wouldn't go with core balance and seasoning, I don't think. I think the way that I would do this is I would take some type of base creature like a skeleton. And from there, I would be like, okay, do I want it to be stronger or weaker than this? And then it's like, okay, well, what do I want to make its kind of gimmick? What does it want to do? And then worry about what he calls the seasoning, the lore and stuff like that, and bring it in that way. And I think that's how I would use this. But this article was fantastic for getting me thinking about that, you know?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. You know me, I'm probably, out of all the people in our group of friends, our biggest lore hound, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So when it comes to building a creature like this, it seems like you have to take into account its environment, you know, like what are its prey? Where is it? You know, you won't shove something like a lizard that would normally live in the desert into the tundra. Like, it just wouldn't work, even if you swap out some stuff.
Yeah.
In my opinion, you kind of have to take his top-level seasoning and kind of mix it around the whole drink before you can sort of figure out what the core is.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of doing it. I think going into it knowing what flair you're going to put on it really helps you nail down those other aspects of it. But either way, I think that this was great for figuring out that for myself, and this is what got me really thinking about this article. But I did want to take a moment and mention his kind of alternative creatures that he creates from the Lich, because I think they were really awesome, starting with like the elemental conduit.
Yeah, what, just out of curiosity, what kind of genre do you think a band that's called Elemental Conduit would be?
I could see it being like techno music, I could see it being metal music, I could see it really hitting anything. Maybe not punk rock, it's like, eh, whatever, but metal I could see, techno, like some I could see some jazz, honestly, in it. How about you?
I kind of agree with you. I was making the point here that the name he chose is so generic that it can fit a broad array of things. However, once you kind of hone in on like what it is, it still makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And do you want to describe what an elemental conduit is?
Yeah, sure. So an elemental conduit is an elemental cultist that has given up their sapience to become a channel for elemental beings to enter our plane. They are humanoid, but clearly made up of chunks of raw elements barely held together. And most importantly, they want everything to return to raw elemental chaos and summon elementals at will. They have a strength of 7, dex of 7, charisma of 18, and 12 HP.
Yeah, and these are using BX stats, obviously, but the stats don't matter as much as what you are pulling from it. They matter for his article because he starts out with like the base Lich stats and then edits it based on those.
Yeah, the stats are mostly just there to show what kind of difference in level they would have compared to the base.
The next one that he mentions is the Tome Golem, which is my favorite, which is just a golem made out of spell books, and it just throws spells out of anger, but doesn't really understand them. It's drawn to absorb more spell tomes, and is extremely flammable, which goes back to that balance part. This is what he was using to highlight that, hey, it has to have some type of weakness, it has to have something that the characters can exploit. I loved it. I thought it was super creative and fun, and I could totally see using that in one of my games.
Yeah, same.
What about the Eternal Apprentice? You want to tell me about that one?
So the Eternal Apprentice was my one. It is basically a lich-like creature. However, they have been bound to servitude to a now dead master. And the kind of caveat here is that if their master's corpse is destroyed, then their spirit is released. The reason I like this so much is because the two main things that liches always seem to want is either power or immortality. And that's something that some higher being can easily worm their way into the head of any power-hungry individual.
And I think it's really great that they kind of have to answer for that, and the fact that they weren't strong enough to do it themselves and just kind of attach themselves to this other strong being.
Exactly. And this kind of reminds me of something. I know that you've played Dragon Age Origins too, at least you told me you have.
Yes, I have.
Just taking the stuff that we've learned in this simple article, you can see it in stuff as big as franchises such as Dragon Age Origins, which is a video game for those of you who don't know, where the mage-like creatures are held in power because a higher power over them, this time being the Templars, holds their phylact, right? It like everything from their weaknesses to who they are could have been made with just this article.
It's pretty good, and I think that's a really good allegory for exactly what is going on and what Chris is trying to pull into. But before we talk about the next article, I figure I would just give Chris McDowell a chance kind of to get some of his information out there. So I looked into him. I've actually seen him a bunch. He wrote both Into the Odd and Electric Bastion Land, which are two really cool settings and RPGs that are out there that focus Electric Bastion Land specifically on this techno fantasy environment, and you've done something to get yourself in hot water and you have to get yourself out, and that's the whole point of it and how it moves forward. The reason why I thought I would give him a little bit of a shout out is that his Kickstarter for Into the Odd is going up on September 21st, which is the day before my birthday. He's doing like a reprint, like a second edition kind of thing. So he's fantastic to look into. To find out more, you can go to bastionland.com, which I will put in the podcast description for this. Without further ado, let's go ahead and get into our second article. Is a bit of a strong word for it. It's more of like a blurb, which I'm totally fine with because it was a useful blurb. But it's called Does Energy Drain Suck? These rules may help if you think it does. And Peyton, why don't you just go ahead and read the five small little bullet points that are there for this one?
The five little bullet points are, number one, wights, wraiths, and other lesser undead drain 1d6 constitution. Specters, vampires, and other greater undead drain 1d4 constitution. Shadows drain 1d6 strength. Scores recover at a rate of 1 per day, and a character drained to 0 and a score is lost and becomes undead of the given type.
I love that last little bullet about becoming an undead. I think that's like a nice little flavor right at the end. What did you think when you read this for the first time? Just out of curiosity.
So, I thought that these mechanics don't suck and that they're interesting. So the header of Does Energy Drain Suck? It kind of caught me for a guard. And that's mostly because these seem more like stat drains to me, I guess, which may technically be considered energy drain in this specific rule set. But in like the broader perspective, when I think of energy drain, I think of like a stamina or fatigue drain, which I find to be a lot more annoying.
So Peyton, I don't know if you know this, but in the original basic and advanced D&D as well, the way that energy drain used to work is that whenever you got energy drained by something, it completely negated one level of experience without a saving throw, and you lost all of the abilities that you got from that one level. So you can see how that would be very, very harmful very, very quick.
Yeah, I could see how that could start stacking and all of a sudden your character's bricked. Would not be fun.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's more what he was going for with the Does Energy Drain Suck? And so he was providing these alternative rules. But the first thing I thought when I read that is, this is DCC. The way that that interacts is exactly how we play DCC for most parts. So I just thought that was a nice little, oh, hey, that's something we use all the time.
Yeah, like you said, we use it all the time, and I think it's fantastic, which is why I was so caught off guard with the header of the page.
And this is written by Gabor Lux. He has a blog spot at beyondfomalhaut.blogspot.com. I will put that in the description because I know I probably did not pronounce that right. It's very well written. I checked it out earlier, and I ended up reading like three articles because I was like, wow, this is really good, and he's still putting up stuff very, very continuously. The art is from Didier Gizerix, which is a French magazine publisher, or author rather, and he put out the Casus Belli RPG magazine in the 70s and 80s, and that was huge for getting RPGs in France. So this piece of art is from that, which I'm sure that you think it looks very old school, probably because it is.
Yeah, exactly. Looks old school is old school.
I just love the trailing sword through the stomach of the specter and it like splitting it in half and just being able to visualize that. I think it's really nice.
Same.
Our last one is, again, less of an article and more of a random table with a blurb. I'll let you explain this one because I know you were really hyped about this one and you enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it's an article that eventually leads on to basically list a table. And it's just a way to spice up really powerful wizards in this case by giving them a rather glaring weakness. And the reason I like this so much is that the cover is just the way that it is made. There's this really weird, obscure, like background writing on the top of the cover. And then in the center, it just says wizard weaknesses. And then it almost looks like a word cloud that you'd see. And as you're reading this, you're just going more and more insane. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of the word cloud, in bold, it says, at this level, you must cheat. So it feels like almost this this pressure has been lifted off of you. And then it goes on into describing like how you can use simple tables like this to create a, you know, an interesting monster really quickly to save time. But it's still written from the perspective of being an insane wizard because you're overworked, because you're prepping for something.
It's one of these fun little gimmicks. It's a D66 table. Before I get too far into it, this was written by Daniel Sell, who also has his own blogspot. It's whatwouldconandoo.blogspot, which I love it because it's super easy to pronounce and read, which is very rare on this show. And the art is actually the cover of the Mazarin the Magician 2012 cover, which I believe is just an ebook. But that is actually, you remember when I was talking about Jack Vance?
If I say yes, will you still provide an overview for the listeners who don't know?
So Jack Vance is the guy who wrote Dying Earth. DCC just did a big Kickstarter on it. It's how I insulted you last episode, talking about, you know, Peyton the pain in my ass.
I know who he is now. I'm just terrible with names. You can yell at me about it.
You're totally fine. So this, I believe, is the ebook cover of that. It's by Lee Ann, which is a, not ghostwriter name, but it's like a stage name almost.
Pen name?
Yeah, pen name. Thank you. It's a pen name of someone named Jean Michael Meyer. You can find them at lee-ann.fr is where their blog is, and they have a bunch of their art up. It's fantastic. But if you want to find out more about them, again, I'll put it in the description. This D66 table is just a bunch of like weird, wonky stuff about a wizard that could be a weakness or just a quirk. For instance, the first one, number 11, is a D66. So obviously you roll 2 6-sided die and determine the result. So at an 11, which is obviously snake eyes, the result is having his hat knocked off. Its special lining was keeping the spells inside. And it's just like fun, quirky things like that. So I figured I'd ask you what your favorites are, and then I'd give my favorites, and we kind of see where we overlap.
So reading through this, I actually have 4 favorites, and I think that they cover a rather wide array of what's possible here. My first favorite is number 23, and it says, The true wizard is an old man behind a curtain in a room beyond, controlling the simulacrum with gossamer tendrils and plasma disappearing off into the ether. Requires a good few hours to rouse himself, so is essentially defenseless. The reason I like this is literally the Wizard of Oz. The next one I liked was number 31.
Oh, I also had that one as one of the ones that I liked.
Yeah, once a year, a particular juncture of the aeons, the wizard goes out amongst the people and into the ear of one of the poor fellows, mutters the word that will unravel his power. The person listening doesn't know that what the word does, but they do know that they will die in a year and a day if they ever reveal it. Anyone else saying is fine and greatly upsets the wizard. The reason I like this is because this table gives so many different options, from like just wacky hijinks to something like this where it could actually turn into something pretty grimdark, where, you know, you have to choose between extracting the word out of this man who says it if he dies to kill someone else.
Yeah, agreed. And I think you could do some fun stuff with whether it actually kills him or if the wizard just said it would kill him just to mess with this poor sop.
Yeah, that kind of ties into number 62.
Oh, gosh.
Which is, the wizard doesn't really have a weakness. He's really great. He will, however, act like he does, begging them to not touch his special deck of cards or say bad words. He finds it funny.
I think you too find that funny.
I find it hilarious, just not only from an in-character perspective, but it's like, hey, you have a rather cocky party who like has been finding their way around every single encounter you have. Lead them on. Make you think it's working, and then all of a sudden it doesn't.
I think that is a fantastic way of dealing with someone like that without necessarily punishing them, and more just kind of messing with them for a little bit. Like, a wizard is the perfect character to do that with.
Yeah.
So my favorites are starting with number 22, which is a demonic parasite which clings to the back of his head. To the ignorant observer, it looks like a rather gaudy evil guy hat, but those viewing it via second sight or true seeing ability know well differently. They must also test their luck or be blinded by the brilliance of the creature's true form. I just love the fact that a demonic parasite can look identical to some guy's wizard hat.
Yeah, it's like the first Harry Potter movie. Everyone thought the guy's head wrap was just for show. Nope, end up being the big bad.
Yeah, exactly. I also had number 31 as well, which is the whispering in the ear one, because I thought that had like a lot of fun plot hooks. But my last favorite, I only had 3, is number 46, which is all of his organs have been put into 2d6 jars and hidden in secret places. Each one found and destroyed takes a portion of his power. I think that is the perfect way of dealing with a big bad evil wizard that you introduce by like killing someone that the party knows really well, that like they know is strong or something like that, really to show that they are strong and that the party can't take them, and then making it so they can take them, making that part of the adventure. You can put them wherever the hell you want because it's a wizard. He could have been wherever the hell he wants.
Yeah, I agree with that point, in that a big campaign villain really hits a lot harder when he personally messes with the party. But if he messes with the party, he can't exactly just be killed right then and there, because that would just defeat the point of him being a villain. So like you said, it gives them a workable goal towards killing him that also doesn't keep him in this insane OP form that'll just one-shot everyone when they do confront him.
It's like the Emerald Enchanter adventure we just ran, where you interact with the Emerald Enchanter early on. He steps out of that table and you can't really kill him right then. I mean, yeah, you could get insanely lucky and somehow kill him, but he's just showing like, hey, you're here. I'm gonna screw you up later. Like, let's tango. Finally, what I thought I would mention, I really liked his closing paragraph where he says, a lot of these things seem like the kind of things that would be incredibly impractical limitations in combat. Remember, they are wizards, not soldiers. Their magic is to further their inscrutable ends, not arm wrestle. Unless they're endomancers, I suppose. And I think that's a great way to look at it and just think about the fact that you don't really know how a wizard is going to act because we don't have wizards. So if they're going to be wonky, go all in.
Yeah, and make it so that you could chase them in a Benny Hill style adventure. Then all of a sudden he turns around and ends up being this scary Cthulhu-like horror monster. The world is your imagination.
The world is your oyster. So our final thing before we wrap up today is we've got some listener questions this time, and they are very good, and I think they're going to get us to kind of talk a little bit. So the first one, these are both from Dave Hoskins, who's a friend of the pod, and some of you may know him from different Discords that you're in. But he says, since you're both in a DCC, what is it specifically about DCC that draws you? I could go on about this for a while, so I'm going to let you go first.
I mean, I could go on it for a while, too. I think the first two articles that we covered last podcast kind of covered why I like it pretty well, but I guess for those of you who need a catching up, I just basically like it because of the open-endedness of it and the way it kind of kneecaps meta builds, if that makes sense, just because of all the randomness that could happen during a singular dungeon. So you're kind of just forced to go with the punches, and it ends up just making this... I mean, like, for example, my character, he has a 1 on almost every stat. He also looks like a snake. He has a rock just floating above his head at sonic speeds, and none of this would happen if it weren't for DCC.
Yeah, agreed. I think the reliance on so many random tables for different things really gets your characters and me as a judge outside of my comfort zone a lot more, because there's a lot of stuff that I in my head would not put in my headcanon for the world, and then it happens through the tables and I'm like, yeah, no, this fits, like this is great. For instance, today there was an extraplanar insane creature that they interacted with that was a pseudopod, and it was intelligent, but it had no way of interacting with them. And one of our characters tried to talk to it, basically offered himself up, was trying to talk a different language, and I would never have brought a thing like this into one of my games, but I was like, hell, I'll roll with it. And so I made it interact with him and like basically show him 100 different lifespans, and he learned all this philosophical knowledge. So he got a boost to his intelligence, but also took permanent HP damage and stuff like that because he lived all these lifespans in his head. His mind was like so full of knowledge that his body couldn't keep up anymore. And that's kind of how I played it.
Yeah, I like that. I like the potion example that we did 2 sessions ago, where it's like depending on what you mixed, you got random results, and we didn't have a book that told us what to mix. So it just kind of throw stuff in and pray.
I think that is something that is invaluable in a game, because I think that while some people have amazing minds, randomness and someone else's mind kind of bleeding into yours is always useful and is going to make your games feel a lot more rich.
Yeah, it also kind of plays into like, no matter how much you want to try and architect a world, you can make it as perfect as you want. If it's just you doing it in a rigid structure, it's gonna feel artificial. You gotta throw some randomness in there somehow, and this is a great way to do it.
Yeah, there's a lot of the old, for instance, with city settings, there's a lot of these old books from the like origins of D&D and RPGs in general, where it's just all tables, and that is gonna make your world feel so much more alive, because if you carefully curate each interaction you're players have in the game world. It's not going to feel real, and it's going to take you right out and make you feel like a video game. And one more instance of this is something that I do, which is it doesn't matter what my players are fighting. I always do random HP for that, and then I describe them as if they were scrawny, muscular, maybe a little bit chunky. Like, I add that variation so that it feels like you're fighting different creatures instead of just carbon copy video game monsters, you know?
Yeah, an example I'd like to show about this is I did it in a 5e game. However, it was something that I carried over because I learned from DCC in this instance, like the whole randomness. So, for example, in my 5e game, this is, of course, 5e, but I brought it in from DCC, which is why I'm using it as an example. My party was about to go to an inn, and outside the inn, they simply asked, like, who do we see? And I could have just said, you know, generic NPC 1, 2, and 3, but, you know, I said, hey, you know, let's have some fun. And I found a generic NPC table, and it wasn't even for D&D, but it was D100, so it worked, right? I just looked it up on Google, and there it was. One of the results they got was a bunch of really high-class, Victorian-era-looking women who wanted to bring people back with them to an all-women party to have a bunch of fun during the night.
That's great.
And they went with it. One of them was even a bard and entertained and was the light of the party. And if I didn't do something random like that because I never played DCC and thought to do it, they would have just stayed at a generic old inn.
Yeah, and I think that ties perfectly into the second question that Dave asked, which is, I know Tristan plays Call of Cthulhu, and you mentioned you'd both played 5e. Since starting to play OSR games, do you find you bring that ethos to different systems when you run or play them? Does, air quotes, OSR need to be built into a rule set, or is it more of a way to play? And I think you kind of touched right on that right off the bat.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, to different people, they may give you different answers. Some people like that their rule set gives them more stuff, but they still want to kind of be confined to it, you know? I was always taught that you can homebrew anything you want in D&D, and I just kind of carried that over to any rule set. So I think that OSR is more of just like a how you play kind of.
Yeah, I think I agree completely, because Call of Cthulhu and 5e and stuff like that, when I run them, I have kind of let the OSR movement, with air quotes, bleed into it. And yeah, I mean, I always use stuff from it. I always keep that high risk, high reward aspect. I always keep that relying on tables. I don't let myself get too bogged down with like, okay, I need to keep this narrative exactly how I want it. I just have kind of started going with the flow a lot more, and it has made me enjoy RPGs so much more. I've stopped burning myself out world designing and stuff like that, and just focused on what I want to do, and that's play games with my friends.
I'd like to give another example, if you'll let me. I know I kind of went hard on the other one.
Yeah, go for it.
My party has a problem where one of the players is playing a barb that has a very, let's just say, very good way of drawing aggro.
Did you say barb or bard?
Barb, as in barbarian. You know, like the thick dudes that get like a half damage from piercing and slashing.
I don't know why, but my head went to a Nicki Minaj fan, which is called a barb.
Oh,
anyway,
sweet Jesus. Go
ahead.
Oh, God. Anyway, I needed a creature that could find a way to not get drawn in by his aggro. So I went with a green hag because it fit their combat rating and it had invisibility and a bunch of spells. And one of the ways that I used to basically force the encounter was that they went to this campsite, and if they failed to save the campsite, they wouldn't be able to leave this growing mist and fog around the campsite.
Yeah.
This kind of plays into one of her abilities. Down along the lines, she used invisibility, and thematically, I had said that the mist envelops her in a way that she becomes very hard to see. And I just said that thematically. I didn't think it would mean anything. However, my cleric then says, oh, well, I have a spell called Create Water. I want to cast Create Water at level 2 to make enough water for a rain cloud and cast it over the mist to dissipate the area so that she becomes uninvisible.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, if I were playing 5e and in the 5e mindset, I would sit there looking through a bunch of tables. Does this work? Does this work? Does this niche mechanic work? Whatever. But because even though I was playing in the in 5e but still in the OSR mindset, I was like, sure, give me a nature roll. And she rolled high. And then the invisibility failed, and the mist around her went away. And everyone that's thought nice. That was, yeah, a fun way to get around it.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's fantastic. And I think that really shows that you've picked up a bunch from this movement. Yeah, I mean, that's all I've got in terms of listener questions. And I think that's fantastic. But all right, everybody. Well, we will see you next week. I am going to be posting the art that we talked about today on our social media. So make sure you go ahead and take a look there if you want to see it. And drop a follow if you get a chance. Until then, I'll catch you later.
Yep, see you later.